Knife, a podcast of the cinema. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. You're Dave White.
We're film critics.
Yeah.
Real ones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, furloughed, but like during this unprecedented time.
Especially now.
And we're gay married.
That too.
I've decided that I like to say gay married.
Gay married?
Gay married.
Okay.
Because I want to set us apart from those people. You know who they are. You know them. You know them, the not queers out there getting married all recklessly.
Higgledy piggledy.
Yeah. We're different.
Sure.
I won't say we're better.
Because that would be tacky. But we all know.
It's cute and all that straight people like to have their little marriages and stuff.
Yes. Yes.
I guess. As long as it doesn't interfere with my life.
Yeah. If they can just not rub it in my face.
Just don't rub it in my face. Yeah.
Straight people need
to... We're done with that joke. Because I say. We were before the mic, while we were doing the mic check, we were talking about how it's been over 3 months now since either one of us have been in a movie theater.
Correct.
My last day in a movie theater was March 2nd or 3rd, no. 3rd, 4th, yeah, 3rd, March 3rd, and I realized, we just were saying, there hasn't been a week in my life, not counting illness,
mm-hmm.
that sort of kept me from it, having the flu or whatever.
Yeah.
There hasn't been a week in my life where I haven't been in a movie theater.
Yeah, I mean, in my adult life, for sure, and even before then, like, at least once or twice a month, even as a child, you know, like...
Yeah.
What's the last movie you saw in the theater?
Zombie Child.
Mm.
The Bertrand Bonello film.
Okay.
At the Lumiere.
Yeah.
Here in Los Angeles.
Mine was First Cow.
Yeah. I mean... And I'm envious of you about that because...
You still haven't seen it.
No, I still haven't seen it because the theater shut down. And, mm-hmm. and then they decided that they wanted to wait until the fall to put it back out.
Yeah, I was kind of... I was surprised. Like, all the other movies of around that period, you know, your Invisible Mans and your Emmas and your Rarely, Never, Sometimes, Always. Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. They were all like, okay, fine, we'll stream.
In fact... You went to see it as I was starting to get sick.
Yeah, no, the next day I had to take you to the clinic.
Yeah.
And then that's when the hunker down began.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I'll tell you though, I'm in no rush to go back.
No.
They are making
not
me,
at all.
Everybody's making me very nervous.
Well, they're making it very easy for me to say no, that's for
yeah.
sure. You know. AMC for starters.
Yeah, no masks. Okay, fine, masks.
Yeah, but the reason that they said no masks...
Yeah, that was the worst.
...was that they didn't want to get involved in a...
Political.
Here's the word, a political controversy.
Over people's beliefs.
Guess what? The virus has no politics. The virus has no beliefs. The virus doesn't give a damn what you think about it or what you believe. It's going to murder you.
Yes.
So, like... That a business, now I understand that they want every dollar they can get because they're on the verge of bankruptcy.
Sure.
But like, damn.
Yeah, that was...
Behave yourself, please.
That was an epic of, like, bad corporate communication.
Yeah.
Because I think by the end of that, everybody was annoyed with them. Whatever
right.
your beliefs happened to be in this matter, you were like, ugh, you blew it, AMC.
But then Regal and Cinemark were saying the same thing. They're like...
Yeah. Staying home.
Not going anywhere.
Staying home.
Not going to your movie theater.
No. But look, the streaming stuff at the moment, just keeps coming. We got
except
five.
First Cow, which is the whole except point cow, of my yes. complaint.
Right? Here. Yes. No. They were like, nope, no streaming for us. We will wait this out. So yeah.
How long are you gonna wait?
I don't know. I mean, look, they've now the Academy Awards just gave them an extra 2 months of eligibility.
And what? Why? I hate that too. Here's why I hate that.
That's a crazy thing.
I don't like that either. Because what the message is that the big studio-driven films that we have already decided are our offerings for the Academy Awards. Mm-hmm. What if they can't be in a movie theater?
Right.
That will diminish them.
Oh,
when
no.
we are trying to give you yet another film that is like the King's Speech.
Another Green Book,
such as
if you
the
will.
Green Book. Like,
well, my question is,
there have been plenty of films released already in this year,
yes,
that are worthy,
absolutely,
of anyone's award consideration. I just happen to have my list right here of recently of 2020 films that I have seen that could definitely be, you know,
award players.
Well, where are they?
Never, rarely, sometimes, always.
I'm almost at that point in the thing.
You didn't prepare for this.
I didn't prepare for this. Vitalina Varela. Emma.
Crip Camp.
I was at home, but. Crip Camp. Yeah, did I write that down? Is that my list? Did I write
it
down
be.
The Crip Camp?
Five Bloods should be on your list.
Five Bloods is on my list. You know, there's a lot.
The half of it.
Oh, I did write down Crip Camp. I didn't see. Did I see the half of it?
Yes.
The half of it is nice.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know. You know.
How condescending.
I'm not trying to be condescending. I'm trying to be rigorous.
Oh, fine. Here. Okay. Yeah. Baku Rao then.
Baku Rao. Totally. Baku Rao. Anyway.
Yeah, what
movies.
I want to know is
movies
like,
are here what, that are good enough. You
if,
guys.
If this year's Oscar qualifying thing is 14 months now,
yeah,
does that mean next year's is going to be 10 months just to like get caught up, or is it going to all? Are they going to suddenly be on a fiscal year that ends on February 28th every year now?
I don't know.
It's baffling.
Everything is terrible.
2020 is just going to have an asterisk next to it anyway, because everything's ruined.
But we have five films
we
to talk
about. We have five films to talk about.
Normally, we don't have that many, but we have five this week.
Yes.
How did we end up watching five new movies?
Well, we had to kick one over from last week because you weren't ready yet.
Which one?
You Don't Know Me.
Oh, that's right. Well, we did watch You Don't Know Me.
Mm-hmm.
We watched it last night, as
yeah,
a matter of fact.
A movie I can't really review, per se, because we screened it at Outfest. I did the Q&A with Jeffrey McHale. Christy and I interviewed him.
Jeffrey McHale is the director.
Is the director and producer.
Yeah.
Christy and I interviewed him for Breakfast All Day's A La Carte. You know. So yeah, I couldn't. It's not a movie I could give a number to or anything. But I am a big fan. I really enjoyed it when I was one of the people who programmed it at Outfest, and I was really interested to see how you were going to go with it, because you get tetchy about Showgirls.
I get annoyed by the popular approach to mm-hmm. Showgirls.
The dunk.
Because, yeah, the dunk. I'm annoyed by the dunk on Showgirls. And I have been, and I need to be very clear here, that I've been on the side of Showgirls is actually genuinely great for a really long time.
Yes.
Even before the smattering of critical reevaluation began, I was on that side.
Yes. You and Jacques Rivette.
I wrote a piece for a magazine back in like 2008 or something. I can't tell you the title of the thing I wrote because it's a quote from the movie and it's filthy.
Yes, well. As so many of the quotes from that movie are.
But the title of the piece I wrote was better than a something, 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 and you know it.
Yes.
And the, so anyway, and I said in the piece that this film is intentional.
Yeah.
The things that happen in this movie are intentional. The directorial choices are intentional. Whatever you may think of
you the may not like them.
Whatever you may think of the script that Verhoeven was working for, Verhoeven has very, very, very specific ideas about life and the world, particularly about American culture.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an intentional film about the vapidity, the hideousness, the banality, the cruelty, the abusiveness of the United States. And if it's too tacky and gross and stupid to look at, then I'm sorry, but that's the world you've built.
Don't blame
Paul Verhoeven.
So 25 years ago, Showgirls was unleashed upon the world. And So You Don't Know Me is a way to sort of explore the reactions, you know, the initial reaction, the sort of ongoing thing. They kind of break it out into three categories, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
Where it goes from piece of ish to masterpiece to masterpiece of ish. And I think that's very valid. And
for sure.
And you know, I know you were pleased.
Because the movie doesn't super take a stance.
No. It
explores those three positions.
Yeah, it talks to people like David Schmader, who's been doing who did the commentary track of the DVD, has been doing like live presentations of the film. Talks to, is it Adam Heyman? Is that his name?
Yes.
Who wrote It Doesn't Suck, which is a defense of Showgirls.
Yes.
Various other critics and cultural observers, and Peaches Christ, who has created all these sort of midnight movie stage shows.
Our friend Matt Baum,
who the host of the Sewers of Paris podcast.
Yeah.
And none of them appear on camera talking.
This is all voiceover.
Yeah, it's all voiceover, and it's over tons of clips from the film, but also they managed to find like all of the sort of
other Verhoeven films as well that are integral to
understanding Showgirls as part of his oeuvre.
Exactly.
Yeah. But also like interviews of the like when the film came out, you know, there's the requisite sitting in a hotel room in front of a potted plant interview that, like, you know, Elizabeth Berkley was doing, that Verhoeven was doing, that Esther Haas, all those folks were doing. And he doesn't, there's no new interviews with anybody involved in the film.
Yeah.
Like, there are people who will talk about, oh, I interviewed Kyle MacLachlan and he told me blah, blah, blah. But like, there's no, you know, and so I think that's what's going to make, when Jeffrey Schwartz finishes Goddess, his Showgirls documentary.
Yes, there's another documentary about Showgirls.
In the pipeline,
made by our friend Jeffrey Schwartz.
Yes.
He directed
the Alan Carr documentary, the fabulous Alan Carr. He directed, what's the Divine documentary?
I Am Divine.
That
you are in.
That I'm in, yes.
Also, Vito. Vito.
And Spine Tingler, the William Castle story, and the documentary about porn star Jack Wrangler.
Yeah.
So he's doing a whole other Showgirls film, and that is, I know we talked to Paul Verhoeven, and he's talked to several other players in the film, so that's going to be, I think, a different take. But this one, I think, it's an interesting piece of, it's almost like scholarship in a way.
It is. It absolutely is, because it's about the reception of the film and the various perspectives that people hold regarding its quality.
And then, like, the repercussions, like, he interviews a woman who played the lead in Showgirls the musical off Broadway, that kind of thing. I love this kind of movie. It is my kind of pop culture jam. Like, we're also going to be talking about Netflix's Disclosure this week. I love a clip-heavy documentary with commentary and, you know, like,
from the journals of Gene Seberg
context,
sort of
film.
Yeah.
You know, or The Celluloid Closet. Any of those kind of movies where you really go into, what are movies telling you and how are they telling them to you? And people giving their own personal perspectives of what they were told and how they received it and what they did with that information.
One of the things that I found most One of the things that resonated me the most about this film was the idea that people are perfectly willing and happy to let Paul Verhoeven explain American culture to them through the prism of violence,
right,
but not through the prism of sex.
Yeah.
Because if you explain it through violence, then you're obviously not endorsing people being slaughtered left and right. But the minute you do it with sex and you lay bare just how tacky sex things can be, people immediately recoil from that and they are, you know, irritated that you're even making them look at it.
And also, I think, you know, when you look at so much of the violence of his films, especially the Hollywood films,
yeah,
it's so exaggerated and bizarre in a way that almost makes you, or that does make you laugh, you
right.
know. But I think when he does the same thing to sex, it just is like, meh.
Well, because inextricably linked to his ideas about human sexuality, the violence is still there.
Of course.
So in a film like Basic Instinct and in a film like Showgirls, there is brutal sexual violence that takes place in both of these films. And that's, you know, that is off-putting. That is a thing that you don't want to look at. There's a reason. This is the reason that David Schmader, when he does his Showgirls
commentary, you know, live,
sort of joking commentary that is mocking the film, he leaves out the most, you know, violent rape scene,
yes,
in the film, like the rape scene in the film, not the most violent one. There's only
the
one.
Only one.
But it's, you know, I think when you do ignore that scene, you're diminishing the nasty,
the totality
point that it's trying to make. Nobody wants to look at it, but it's there intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, for me, I'm glad I saw this movie. I'm glad it exists. I am more on the side of masterpiece that's very rough and trashy,
mm-hmm,
than the, oh, this is crap and let's make fun of it. I've been to plenty of Showgirls viewing parties hosted, mm-hmm, by friends of ours who have used to do it fairly routinely and now haven't done it in a while, but early on in those gatherings, people would, you know, talk to me and I'd say, this isn't actually a bad film. And I got into like heated discussions with the friends who hosted those parties, mm-hmm, by saying, no, I'm absolutely in disagreement with the entire premise of this party, but I'm here to have a good time.
I question your party, sir.
Yeah, no, I'm here to have a good time because we're friends, but I'm not in the camp here.
Sure.
Yes. Are y'all saying funny stuff while we watch the movie? Yes. Am I laughing? Yes. Is it fun to do that? Sure. But, you know, like I went to one of the Schmader screenings.
At Outfest.
Yeah. And I disagree with almost every single thing he has to say. Mm-hmm. I've never met him. I'm sure he's very nice. But I disagree with pretty much every single thing he has to say about this film.
Mm-hmm.
And even he has really funny stuff to say about this film that makes me laugh. But I think after I laugh, I think, yeah, but I think you're wrong.
I've always kind of had one foot in each camp, which I know sounds like a cop-out, but
no,
I mean...
No, I don't think it's a cop-out at all.
I think
that it perfectly aligns with the final chunk of the movie.
Yeah, and yeah. I think there are a lot of movies that way where, like, I start out goofing on them, but then I see... There's something about them that makes me watch them over and over again anyway,
yeah,
which means that clearly they have some sort of fascination and some sort of hold. So, you know, like the apple, like the Mexican Santa Claus, I almost come out the other end of it like, no, maybe this is great.
Yeah.
but I still see where it's also garbage. Like, I don't know. I
think Showgirls is a religious film.
Sure.
I think it's a religious drama. I think it is a story about martyrdom and sacrifice and redemption in the nastiest environment that you can think of. And not because everyone's naked, but because everyone is so vile,
yeah,
to every other human being in the film. There's only one good human being in the movie, and that's Molly.
Who gets raped.
And she is the one who receives the worst of it.
Right.
And then there is the person who is... whose name is literally Christ. Like, Oh, I named myself after the champagne. No, you're supposed to be the person who's martyred at the end of the film so that Nomi, who has no me to her, can live.
That's
what this movie's about.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny. I think they could have very easily set this movie in the world of Los Angeles and the film industry, and the film industry would have lost their minds and been like, oh, no, never. What are you talking about?
We're so much classier than Las Vegas.
But if you make it Vegas, then it's allowed to be garish and awful.
1995, Las Vegas had not yet been Celine Dionified.
Right.
The minute Celine Dion came along and made Vegas
palatable,
tasteful for people to go to. Yeah. Like, suddenly, you actually had Janet Jackson doing a residency. You have Mariah Carey. You have, you know, Britney Spears and all these people who are like, a few decades back,
would never have
been the kiss of death
to
do a show in Vegas, because that would have meant that you were on the downfall.
Right.
It's
like going to Branson.
And I want to explain a little bit more my perspective about this as a religious film. Verhoeven himself has a religious obsession that snakes its way through almost every one of his movies. And that is, like, he's very famously has wanted to direct a film about the life of Christ. Hasn't done it, probably never will, but that's been a thing he's wanted to do for a long time. And if you read his films through that lens, you see what he's doing. Each and every, every time, but a lot of the times, he's telling stories about sacrifice and redemption and brutality and martyrdom.
And this movie is so up to date that it's got clips from Elle in it. So it does a pretty good job.
And Black Book, which, if you like Showgirls, you should watch Black Book, because the premise is very similar. There's a young woman who has a rootlessness, you know, about her, who does whatever it takes to survive the Third Reich.
And if you don't like Showgirls, as I say, it has subtitles and Nazis, so you can feel like you're watching an art film.
Yeah.
Yeah, Black Book is great. And You Don't Know Me is terrific, and it's streaming now. You should check it out. And then, as I mentioned, Disclosure on Netflix is great.
Like, I'm applauding Disclosure
it's
right now.
It's so good.
We watched it the other night. It is a documentary about trans representation in the media.
Yeah.
It is celluloid closet level, like, educational experience.
Yeah, but also emotional.
It is also emotional. So what you have is produced by Laverne Cox.
Mm-hmm. Directed by Sam Fader.
And they interview most, if not all, of the people in the entertainment industry who are
a lot of the major
trans
players.
Lana Wachowski not in it. Lily is.
Jen Richards and Jamie Clayton and Alex Billings and Laverne Cox. A lot of actors that I don't necessarily know their work. Leo Shang from L Word Generation Q.
Yeah.
Like, pretty much everybody on camera talking in this movie is a trans person.
And you go, they take you from, like, the silent era.
Yeah.
Through, like, the production code years of Hollywood, through television,
everything
up to now.
Like, serious television, but also, like, the Jerry Springer Show.
Right. Yes. Exactly.
Where they're talking about how, like, for a long time, this was where you saw trans people on television. This was the one place that they would, and as garishly, you know, portrayed as it was, and as, like, you know, tacky as the show was, they were at least there and telling their stories.
Right. So, what I found so wonderful about this is, like, I want to go back with a notepad.
Yes.
So that I can write down
titles.
The titles of things I've never seen. Because I feel like, very much like with the celluloid closet, I learned stuff watching the celluloid closet. I didn't know that Algy the Miner existed until I saw celluloid closet. I didn't know
Our Betters
existed until celluloid closet. And you recently introduced our betters on Turner Classic Movies with Dave Karger. It's a 1933 George Cukor film, which is steeped in queer everything and has a incidental character show up in the last 5 minutes of the movie that turns everything on its head.
Yeah.
And so films like that, I didn't know they existed until I saw Celluloid Closet. I had never really known or thought much about Rebecca until I saw the Celluloid Closet. The Fox, The Sergeant, Some of My Best Friends Are.
The Detective.
The Detective. You know, these films that portray queer people as sad, sick,
dangerous
villains, dangerous murderers. And then the more visibility that queer people got, they stopped being, not always, but they mostly stopped being murderers and villains and sick and became jokes.
Yeah.
And so then you had things like Partners.
Yeah.
La Cage aux Folles, where queer people were just, their lives were just sort of like, you know, silly. Ooh, like joke.
The Neighbor in St. Elmo's Fire.
The Neighbor in St. Elmo's Fire. Oh, that poor dude.
Perfect strawberry perched on the edge of his glass.
Yeah. Anyway, so this film, I need to go back and watch it again. I need to have my notepad because I knew, but I didn't know everything that I should know. And what The Celluloid Closet did for straight people to open their eyes to what had always been in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
This movie does that for a cisgender audience.
Yeah.
Of people who always knew that trans people were treated horrifically in narrative entertainment.
Right.
But boy, that cumulative effect
of
seeing clip after clip after clip, example after example after example, and you just, by the end of it, you are overwhelmed by the enormity of
just like the Crying Game and then the mid-90s moment of let's do a spoof of the Crying Game moments from like
with Ace Ventura.
Naked Gun and Ace Ventura. Yeah. It's like,
Yeah, and then, and that's the thing. As the world moved forward, mm-hmm. as the decades rolled through, I remember when The Crying Game was released. And I remember feeling at the time that finally there was a movie with a major character who was trans who was treated like a human being.
Mm.
In spite of the fact that the reaction to her from
Stephen
Ray's character is that he's shocked and then he vomits.
Yeah.
By the end of the film, you know, you're thinking, okay, good. Finally, there's a trans movie, a narrative feature. Paris is Burning had come out a couple of years earlier.
Yeah, a documentary.
But there was a narrative feature that presented a trans character as a person. A sympathetic person. And so,
and of course the interviewees here have their own take.
Exactly.
On The Crying Game.
Exactly. Because each person in the film that they interview about The Crying Game says, I get it. That was 93. It felt like something. But the reaction to this character is that Stephen Ray throws up and now it's going to be a joke that every time you see a trans person in a comedy, someone has to go throw up. And then they show you clip after clip after clip of that.
And Laverne Cox talks about how basically the movies and TV train cis people how to react to trans people.
Yes.
And she talks about like getting on a subway car early in her transition and people laughing.
People just openly laughing at her.
But like, but before that, the movies and TV were teaching people to become violent.
Right.
So, you know, this was so eye-opening. And the personal stories are so moving. Jen Richards has this like uninterrupted monologue.
It's a couple minutes long.
Yeah, about a thing that you probably don't even remember seeing it.
Right.
In the show I Am Kate.
Yes.
The reality show that Caitlyn Jenner did, where there's like this support group for parents of trans kids, and this one dad is like so supportive and so embracing and so celebratory of having a trans kid, and Jen Richards having to process her feelings about what that meant to her and what it meant to her responses to the people in her life and what it meant to her responses to herself.
Right.
It's one of
because not only does the media teach you how to respond to people who are different from you, it teaches you
what you think about yourself,
the different person, what you think about yourself.
Yeah. That's one of the most devastating things I've seen in a movie in a good long while.
I love this documentary. I think everybody should watch it.
Yes.
And what I really want to know is from trans listeners to this show who watch it, did they leave anything out?
Yeah, do they? Because they cover a lot of ground.
They cover a lot.
They talk about,
but no documentary can cover everything.
Of course, right? Nor can no one movie ever is going to.
Right.
But they talk about intersectionality a lot. They talk about race. They talk about the trans masculine experience versus the trans feminine experience. Yep. They call out the gay and lesbian community for not having been supportive of trans issues for so long. There's a lot to unpack here, and this is not Broccoli. This is a really entertaining movie about like media history and
It moves. It's not a school lesson.
No,
it is. You're going to learn a lot.
Yeah.
But, it's super engaging, and it left me with the feeling of, you know, all the years that I've talked to, you know, all the trans folks in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And learning bit by bit and thing by thing and just having friendships with people. And, you know, reading, and still a film like this comes along and you think, oh, wow, there's still so much.
I don't know anything.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yance Ford. I could listen to Yance Ford talk for hours. The director of Strong Island. He's fascinating.
Yeah.
The wonderful Travell Anderson is in it.
Travell's in it, too.
A great lineup of people. Watch this movie. It's on Netflix now. Disclosure.
Netflix.
What did I say?
You said, it's on Netflix now. And I wanted to make it clear that you were saying the word Netflix.
It is currently available on Netflix.
Please always speak now in a mid-Atlantic accent.
Oh, do.
Please.
So that's the good stuff.
No. There's one more.
Oh, there's one more. That's right. Miss Juneteenth. Miss Juneteenth.
Speaking of eye-opening.
Yes.
This week has taught me a thing. As a person from Texas.
Yes.
Who has, I don't remember when I didn't know about Juneteenth. Like, my family moved to Texas when I was just out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, we lived in what is essentially west Texas. We lived in southeastern New Mexico. And Juneteenth was, known there as well. Even though it was, you know, originally specifically sort of a Texas thing. So I don't remember a time when I didn't know what Juneteenth was and that it was a big holiday and a party and a celebration. And I'll tell you something, this week, hearing all the folks that I see on like Twitter and Instagram say, hey, I just learned about Juneteenth. And I'm like, okay, fine. You live in, Vermont or whatever. I get it.
I'll tell you, I didn't know what it was until I moved to Texas, and that's on me because I grew up in Atlanta, and I'm sure something was going on. I'm sure it was being celebrated. I'm sure it was being noted, and I missed it. But definitely, you live in Texas, you know what Juneteenth is.
You know what Juneteenth is when you live in Texas.
So Miss Juneteenth, directorial debut of Channing Godfrey Peoples, who is a native Fort Worther herself.
Yeah.
And speaking of the awards conversation, it stars Nicole Beharie.
Who deserves one.
Yeah. Oh, man. She plays a woman named Turquoise. She was, in her teen years, Miss Juneteenth.
In Fort Worth.
In Fort Worth. Yeah. It's a big pageant, big scholarship competition.
Well, you get a full ride.
Yeah, but yeah. it's a pageant. They got to wear dresses.
But you still get a full ride to college if you win.
I know that. But it's just that...
doesn't matter.
Scholarship competition has become the euphemism for, you know...
I know.
Anyway, it's a pageant. And her life did not necessarily follow the route that that was expected. You know, she did not attend the historically black college that she got a won a scholarship to.
Right.
She got pregnant instead, and so now her daughter is turning 15 and is old enough to enter the pageant herself. So Turquoise very much is investing a lot of time and money and effort into entering her daughter into this competition and letting her, having her follow in her footsteps.
Stage parenting the child.
Very much stage parenting. Her daughter, Kai, played by Alexis Chakwasi, who is, it's her first film, not so interested in the Miss Juneteenth pageant.
That's an understatement. She does not want
anything. Does not really want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, meanwhile, Turquoise has been working for a long time in this neighborhood, like, barbecue joint.
Yeah.
And over the course of the film, she may take a more active role in the ownership and running of the place.
Yes.
And what's interesting is that, like, you know, you see these glimpses of how the pageant works and who's putting it on. And clearly for the pageant organizers, there is a path for you to follow, you know.
Yes.
You know which is the salad fork and which is the fish fork, and then you attend the historically black college or university, and then.
Right.
And over the course of the film, we get to know Turquoise and Kai, and they have their own, you know, destinations in mind. And by the end of the film, they're excellent too. They're just not, you know, Miss Juneteenth excellent.
What this really is, in many ways, is a film about, you know, expectations placed on kids by parents, expectations placed on folks within, you know, specific communities, and the bristling against that or the acceptance of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Turquoise's idea is, and it's one that she never says out loud, because to say it out loud would be to reject the person she loves the most. Had I not become a teen mom,
mm-hmm. this would have been my life.
My life would have been beautiful, maybe, mm-hmm. the way that I always dreamed it would be. But she became a mom. And so she's going to take that dream and force her daughter
kicking and screaming
to take it. And the daughter is constantly like, all but rolling her eyes, like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be in this dress. I don't want you to spend the money on this dress. It is a very gentle, thoughtful film about parents and children and how they, you know, work to either change each other or defy each other. There's a very naturalist sort of filmmaking going on that I really love. Nothing feels presented to you. It feels like the camera just happens to be on
mm-hmm.
while people are living their lives.
And you'll catch up.
To that end, bits of information about Turquoise are left out. You don't know the path that she followed, really, after having a baby. Trickles of information come along,
and you
hear people talk to her.
Kai's father is still around,
but not fully in the picture all the time. He just kind of pops in whenever. So the filmmaking style has this very low key quality,
unobtrusive,
that allows the story to unfold in a very sort of organic way.
Yeah.
And I, it's not melodramatic. It's not
forced
or pitched or anything like that.
I would have liked a little more about Turquoise's mom, because what we find out is very complicated.
Yes. Yes. And that's, I mean, and you think really when you get to know the character of the mother, that you do understand part of why Turquoise stuck around.
Mm.
You know, she didn't go off to college.
Yeah.
Maybe having the baby wasn't the only thing.
Sure.
That was keeping her, you know, there. Maybe she felt obligated to be there to keep an eye on mom. Mm. And so, but again, much like the relationship with the daughter, that's unspoken.
Right.
There is, you know, it's a film about what do you do when the people you love the most are also part of your burden.
Right.
And that's what this character has to deal with. I love how regionally specific it is, because the minute I realized it was Fort Worth, I thought, oh yes, this is extremely Fort Worth. Yeah, I lived there for a while. So
there's a shot of brisket being and there's, in the barbecue
yes,
place.
That's, yeah, neither here nor there, but
I
really
I was going to pass
so much
out.
Good brisket happening. There's also, you know, what I don't like a lot of contemporary independent American cinema, because very much like, you know, mainstream pop culture, there's this flattened quality to regionalisms.
Sure.
You know, and this film digs right into it.
Yes.
And so there is just a wonderful specific and understated quality,
yeah,
to everything on screen. It's really an impressive first feature.
Yes.
So I want to see more
for sure
from her.
Yeah.
That's all. It's on. It is also on Netflix, or
no? It's for rental.
It's you can stream it.
You can stream it in, you know,
iTunes, Amazon,
whatever,
usual wherever
places.
You can.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So if you just found out what Juneteenth is this week, or if you've always known what Juneteenth is,
celebrate with mystery.
Absolutely, it's really lovely.
It is. Yeah. Okay. Those were the good movies. Now we get to the not so good ones.
Okay.
But before that,
yeah,
we have a sponsor.
Yes, we do.
A returning sponsor.
Hey, it's time for an advertisement, and it's not for us.
Nope. It's for our good friends over at Ovid.
They're back.
Ovid, named after the Roman poet and not COVID, like us to point out.
Yes.
They're different. Started with help from 8 independent film studios, Ovid now streams more than 800 titles, most of which can't be found anywhere else.
Correct.
And they add 20 to 35 new films a month. But unlike other services, they don't drop nearly as many. So that's good news for subscribers. The collection at Ovid, always growing. So yeah, between Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus, HBO Now, HBO Max, you might feel like you have binged too much. But Ovid is an alternative. It is the home for the best independent films, global cinema, social issue, and documentary films. Films, if you will, from an independent world.
The new stuff this week is Piero Messina's La Lessa with Juliette Binoche.
La Tessa.
Oh, did I say that wrong? Oh, I did. I wrote it down wrong. Doi. La Tessa.
Which I saw at Venice a couple years ago.
Did you really?
Yeah, it's good.
And another film called Polina, both of which star Juliette Binoche.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen either one of these. Tell me about La Tessa.
La Tessa is about she plays a prospective mother-in-law, and her young daughter-in-law-to-be comes to visit her at their country home where she's supposed to meet up with the son.
Right.
And as time passes and he does not arrive, there is sort of a complicated web of what is happening and who knows and what are they saying.
Oh.
It's really good.
I'll watch that.
Yeah.
There's also a film from Henrik Ruben Gens calls called Terribly Happy. I'm sure I just killed his name. Apologies. Called Terribly Happy. I also haven't seen that. But what we have seen
yes.
on Ovid is the Shirley Chisholm documentary called yes. Unbought and Unbossed. Yes.
Chisholm 72. And if you just watched Mrs. America on
Which
Hulu,
is why we watched it. Because yes. we watched all of Mrs. America and Shirley Chisholm gets an episode.
Uzo Aduba plays her.
But you really want to know more about Shirley Chisholm because she was remarkable.
Yeah.
And so this documentary is all about who she was, what she did.
How groundbreaking it was for a black woman to run for president. Well, really, ever. But in 1972, certainly.
And an outspoken advocate for queer people mm-hmm. in the 70s.
Yes.
Which...
when it was decidedly not cool.
Well, yeah. It was like... you
political
know,
suicide.
It was political suicide. And so... So she's a hero.
Yeah. And also they've got Peter Greenaway's The Pillow Book. A personal favorite.
From the era of Ewan McGregor being naked.
Yes. Back when Ewan McGregor couldn't be naked enough in a movie, we get The Pillow Book.
Like, I think back then, like, he just said, what movie is this? And do I get to take off all of my clothes? No? Well, then I won't do your film. Yeah.
Can't be bothered.
Yes? I'm in.
Ovid even offers a free 14-day trial period, and then after that, it's just $6.99 a month or $69.99 annually. So head over to www.ovidiv.tv, Ovid.tv. They just launched a new platform. It's newly designed. Take a look. Get started. Sign up.
You should. It's really great. We really, really like them a yeah. lot. We would... as I've said before, when we used to do ads for them, I would be watching them anyway. I would be talking about them anyway.
Absolutely.
They're very cool.
Yes. Moving on. A movie you would think would be a really cool international film.
Olivier Assayas,
you guys. Arguably one of the most interesting filmmakers alive and working right now. Sometimes we make a boo-boo. Sometimes the great artists miss a beat and make a mistake.
Yeah.
And so we get Wasp Network.
Wasp Network.
A movie that I've now had to watch twice.
Explain why.
Well, it premiered last year at the Venice Film Festival.
Oh no, someone had to go to Italy and eat a lot of gelato and beautiful Italian food in Venice and see a bunch of movies.
I know.
Poor me.
Well, anyway, so I saw Wasp Network and was not crazy about it. And right.
I remember you came home and you talked about it and you were like, oh, the new Olivier Assayas is bad. And I was like, you're stupid.
Yeah. It's on me. I didn't get it. So then they announced that it was going to drop on Netflix. And they're like, well, you know, he's re-edited it since Venice. So you really have to watch it again to review it because, you know, it's a totally different thing.
Shall I?
I watched it again. It is not totally different.
Okay, this film stars, check out this cast, you guys.
Yeah.
Penelope Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
Edgar Ramirez.
Mm-hmm.
Gael Garcia Bernal.
Yep.
Ana de Armas.
Yep.
And a bunch of other folks.
Wagner Mora.
It is the early 90s, and there are Cuban rebel groups in Florida that attack Cuba.
Yes.
To protest Castro.
Yeah, they are ostensibly sort of, organizations that fly humanitarian missions over the sea between Miami and Cuba to help out, like, the flotillas, the people who are escaping for freedom. But, you know, they might run some drugs on the side, and they might be
You gotta make some money.
They might be hiring some mercenaries to plant bombs at resorts in Cuba to try and damage the country's fragile economy by going after their tourism market.
Yes. So, to retaliate, the Cuban government has spies.
Yes.
And this is all a true story, so it doesn't really spoil it if we tell you that the people who start the movie... and you think they are refugees, they are actually spies.
Yeah, they one of them, Edgar Ramirez defects via plane, and then Wagner Moura's character swims to Guantanamo Bay and surrenders at the base there. And in both cases, they're like, oh yes, Cuba's falling apart. I wanted to come to freedom. And Edgar Ramirez leaves behind his wife, Penelope Cruz, and his baby daughter, and they don't know the truth. So Penelope Cruz just assumes her husband is a defector and a traitor to Cuba and has to live with that as somebody who stayed behind in Cuba.
Yeah. It's based on a book. Olivier Assayas adapted the book, directed it, and you can feel him struggling with the material. How to make, long exposition, sequences where people are just talking about what they have to do and what they're about to do and what they've done. How to make that interesting.
There are so many scenes of people sitting at tables in restaurants
and
explaining everything to each other and to the audience.
And for a film about stuff that is really high stakes, you stop caring after a while. Because it doesn't, and it's something that you don't care about the situation if it were presented to you in documentary form.
Yeah.
But the narrative elements of this film are so leaden.
Yeah, there are life and death incidents going on, and it just never picks up.
There is one sequence of a person who is tasked with committing a terrorist act. That is suspenseful.
Yes.
There are other scenes, every single one that has Penelope Cruz in it, where you feel the stakes, where you feel the emotion of what's going on in this woman's life and how she is an unwitting and unwilling participant in the life of a man she thought she knew.
Right.
And the child actor who plays the daughter, same thing.
Yeah.
You feel the anguish coming from this child over being abandoned.
Yeah, when the movie is about the human element of these characters, it's a lot more interesting than it is about the espionage.
And that's always what Olivier Assayas has been good at.
Yeah, but there's so much espionage in this movie.
Yeah. It feels like something too big.
It should have been like a 5-episode HBO series.
Right.
I mean, like, how long was Carlos? That was like 7 hours or something, right? It was 2 parts.
It was long.
You know, he needs that kind of real estate to spread out in, because this story just feels... Yeah, leaden is the word.
I admire Olivier Assayas. I've always liked his films. Even people you really dig can make something that's sort of a lump of wet.
A limp noodle.
Nothing. Yeah.
Dave.
What?
Dave.
What?
Dave.
What?
You should have left.
Oh, we're done talking about Olivier Assayas?
I think we are.
We're talking about You Should Have Left?
Yes.
Okay. All right, I'm going to try to explain what it's about. Kevin Bacon and
Amanda
Seyfried are married. And before the film was released, or right as the time it was released, I saw on Twitter a lot of things like, well, get a load of this casting. He's 61 and she's 34. And that's, bad. And then you realize within 10 minutes, no, that's one of the
points of the movie.
It's one of the points of the movie is that they're in this intergenerational marriage. And there's a reason for that. And there are reasons why it's bad for other reasons. And so, but anyway... Amanda Seyfried, she is a movie star. Her character is a movie star.
Yes.
And she's married to Kevin Bacon, who is a former
banker.
Richie Rich kind of Wall Street banker.
Yeah.
But he's not doing that anymore. He's like, he stays home with the kid.
Yeah.
And so she goes off and she's in, Furious 7 or whatever. And he's jealous of her, love scenes in films. And you think, as you're watching him be jealous in the first 5 minutes of the movie, what's your problem? You marry a movie star and you're going to be all, man, I don't like you kissing other people. Well,
yeah. It's what you signed up for.
What did you think was going to happen? So they go on a little vacation to Wales. It's Wales. They go to Wales.
They found a house online.
And the minute you see this house, you realize that everyone is going to die.
No good can come of this.
It is the kind of house that is on the cover of Dwell magazine. It's this large, imposing, stern, modernist
barn-like
thing. It's got, like, you know, several large windows, but too much else that has no windows on it at all. Like a luxury prison.
Mm.
And the minute they walk in, and they've got their little kid with them who's like six.
Yeah. Played by Avery Q. Essex.
The minute they walk in, they say, wow, it seems so much bigger on the inside than the outside. And then you find out, oh, it's much bigger on the inside than the outside. And where do all these halls go to? And why are there all these halls with no windows? And why is there a framed photograph of the house inside the house? And who keeps opening these doors when I've just been sitting here in this room all by myself? And why am I seeing Polaroids of strangers who have previously been in this house hanging on the walls? And why is the guy in the village giving me a right angle measuring instrument with my vegetable box and telling me, go use it? And then you go use it, and you find out that the walls aren't at right angles. Why are all these things happening? And why are you having dreams about, oh, I don't know, your family being murdered?
And what the thing that you're infamous for involving your first wife?
Where did she go? Well, I'll tell you the answer to all of this. They're in a stupid haunted house in hell. Perhaps the stupidest haunted house in hell. The last stupid haunted house on the left in hell.
The Blumhouse house.
Yeah. The ridiculousness of this and the
leadenness.
The no suspense, no fear at all.
Yeah.
Ness of this.
The no stakes.
Halfway through, all I could think of was, have you seen the meme of Tiffany, aka New York from Flavor of Love?
Mm.
And I don't know if this meme comes from Flavor of Love or if it's from I Love New York, because she had her own spinoff reality.
Right.
But she's the one that says, the meme that goes, see, you should have just sat there and ate your food. Like scolding someone for talking, saying something idiotic. That's all I kept thinking about during this, because the movie's called You Should Have Left. I was like, yeah, no, before you should have left, you should have just sat there and ate your food. Yeah. It's so if you're thinking of a comedy meme halfway through a horror movie, the horror movie is ineffective.
You shouldn't have bothered. It's a letdown. We do not have time for letters real quick this week just because we have so much ground to cover. But I do, of course, want to mention we have a Patreon.
We do.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Lots of extra content, lots of fun prizes, and online hangouts and all kinds of things.
Hey, speaking of that.
Yes.
I have a special message for certain Patreon members.
Yes.
Are you at the $12 level? Are you at the level called Veruca, a.k.a. Veruca Salt from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory? Are you at that level? If you are, I would love it if you would email me at dlelandwhite1964@gmail.com. dlelandwhite1964@gmail.com. Because a weird techie glitch has happened in the world of Patreon, and all the $12 level has been eliminated.
You have to jump into the new $12
level. Let me explain it.
Sorry.
I am working on correcting this problem. It's not that you have been eliminated.
No.
You are still in Patreon.
Yes.
You just are free floating now in the sea.
In the phantom
of
zone.
Subscribers. Yeah. The $12 level is the level where, you know, because you are in that level, that means you get to see everything, all the extra content. So if you are at the $1 level or the $4 level and you're wondering why you're suddenly seeing, why suddenly you are allowed to hear LKTV and Linoleum Knife and Fork, it's because we have opened up all the content to everybody.
Until we fix
the $12 problem. So like I say, don't worry, $12 people, you haven't been erased.
No.
But the level got erased, and now that I've put the level back in, we have to re-add you to it by moving you, shifting you, and there's a role you play in this, and it involves you like re-adding yourself. And I'll explain it all, but shoot me a line, say, hey Dave, how do I help fix this? And I'll give you the information you need.
There you go. So yeah, LKTV, a podcast of television, Linoleum Knife and Fork, a podcast hosted by two film critics.
Yeah.
Lots of things. So go visit, check it out, join at 12, and you'll be in the new level and you'll be all taken care of. Anyway, also wanted real quick, do you have a streaming or Blu-ray pick? Or
I want to recommend
on YouTube, there's a 3-episode series called Her Story that Jen Richards created.
Yes.
Directed by Sidney Freeland, whom I adore, who did the feature film Drunk Town's Finest.
Uh-huh.
I got to do a wonderful Q&A with them and a lot of the people involved with Her Story. This was a web series that was nominated for an Emmy, and every other web series that got nominated for an Emmy that year was basically the sort of web spin-off of a network show.
Right.
This was the one original web content show that got an Emmy nomination.
Yeah.
It's that good. So yeah, go look for Her Story on YouTube. It's terrific. And
you caught me at blank on having a streaming thing this
week.
No
worries. Anyway.
It's because you made me watch 5 movies for this episode.
I know, so much. Thank you all for listening. First of all, check out the other shows that I co-host, please.
There are so many.
Yes. Check out Breakfast All Day with my old crew from What the Flick. Check out Who Shot You on the Maximum Fun Network. My new show, A Film and a Movie, that just launched on the Bramble Jam Network. Where Dan from Deck the Hallmark and I, every week we'll connect a classic film to a recent favorite. Right now we have 2 episodes out. Matt Seitz joins us to talk about The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and La La Land. Amy Nicholson came on to discuss Scenes from a Marriage and Marriage Story. This Wednesday we'll have a new episode with Justin Chang from the LA Times and Fresh Air talking about The Rules of the Game and Magnolia.
And these are the practice episodes, really, so that when you get to me in July...
At some point,
That, you know...
We'll have it down.
You'll have a real podcast.
Okay.
At that point.
Good.
I'm glad these folks, you know, have come in to help you guys sort of figure
like
out
a dress
how
rehearsal,
to do a podcast.
A technical.
And that way, when I finally
swan in,
then everything will be to my liking.
That's, yes, excellent. let's see. Who else? Go check out what Bibbs and Whitney are up to at the Critically Acclaimed Network. Listen to The Schmoes Know. Dennis Enun with Dennis Hensley. The Comics Canon. The aforementioned Sewers of Paris. All Things Cozy. Deck the Hallmark. Big Fat Gay Podcast. Fat Guys of the Movies. The Criterion Cast. And Secretly Timid. Subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. Do leave us a 5-star review. They help immensely. And we will read your 5-star review here on the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, which includes Stitcher Radio and Spotify and Google Play, thelounge.com, CastBox, Podbean, just about all the places where that catch pods. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. You can follow him on Twitter at Bluetopia, BLUTOPIA. That's also his YouTube channel where you can catch up with all of his music videos. I love his stuff. And, of course, you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again, Ovid.tv, for your sponsorship. Thank you to all of our Patreon members. Until next time.
Goodbye.